You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, let's start this bad boy. I'm excited to get involved and talk about these books. Matthew May is the author of The Laws of Subtraction, Six Simple Rules for Winning in the Age of Excess Everything, as well as three previous award-winning books, The Elegant Solution in Pursuit of Elegance and The Shibumi Strategy. He's a popular speaker, creativity coach, close advisor on innovation to companies such as ADP, Edmunds, Intuit, and Toyota. Blah, blah, blah. The bottom line is you got a strong jaw, a mane of dirty blonde hair, and you're very smart. And I really love these books. And I guess we'll start with the idea that one of the life-changing ideas that kind of hit me too late in life, unfortunately, was the notion that the way to think, and even to define the way to define mental toughness, you know, the idea is thinking is this active process. But people, I heard a soldier, a special forces soldier, define mental toughness as learning what not to think about, learning not to define yourself in certain circumstances, learning to not indulge in what's wrong, but rather to indulge in what's right, and thinking. And being creative is more a process of deletion than it is addition. So I guess I'll start with that very deep and profound insight.
Well, okay, let's start there. That is that's a piece of wisdom that actually landed on me when I was sort of at my wit's end in a project with Toyota.
We're getting some background sound.
Never mind.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you were working with Toyota, and tell us how that happened.
Well, you know, when you I was about 4 years into a project with Toyota, and they had hired me to help them get certain ideas through the organization, through the culture. And when you're hired for that kind of thing, you're hired for ideas, and you run out of them, it's not a good thing. But that's exactly what happened to me, and I was sort of at my wit's end, banging my head against the wall, trying to figure out how I help this company. What should I do? And I was 1 foot out the door. I was sort of a captive consultant, if you will. Mm-hmm. They bought all of my time for what turned out to be 8 years running. But you know, I was halfway out the door, saying I really can't help you. When I came into the workplace one day, a little piece of wisdom, not unlike what you just mentioned, was on a sticky on the back of the chair that I sat in, and it was about 2,500-year-old wisdom by a guy by the name of Lao Tzu, and it went something like, to attain knowledge, add things every day. To attain wisdom, subtract things every day. And I began to think about the problem I was working on in a completely different way, not what I should be doing, but what I should be not doing or removing. So that's my experience that actually changed the way I looked at that problem, allowed me to finish that project, and I spent another 4 years with Toyota before I sort of took the show on the road.
You have some amazing examples. I love the example of Michelangelo when he looked at the David, the statue of David, well, the piece of marble, and said, I just got everything out of the way. It kind of, in other words, it kind of already existed in there, and I just sort of had to get all the crap out of the way. All the marble that wasn't needed. It's a kind of a beautiful way to look at things, you know, to kind of define things that way. You know, I had an acting teacher one time who looked at our class, and it was all pretty well-known, a lot of well-known actors, or at least working actors. And he said, you know, being a star is easy, man. You know, it's hard getting rid of all the crap that gets in your own way. Most of you are doing about 10 things every day to ensure your failure. And I never forgot that. And that's why I'm a sometimes working actor that people barely recognize. But sorry, Hunter, stop laughing in a high pitched way. Take me seriously.
You know, talk about acting and subtraction. One of my favorite actors of all times is Sean Penn, and I remember the movie. I think it's Bad Boys.
He's in great prison. Movie. Yeah, man.
That final scene where he doesn't say a word, but you see his face go through virtually every human emotion possible, and you inject yourself into his brain, and you feel everything he feels, but he doesn't say a word.
Yeah, man. You define, you know, you have a lot of examples of art, and you're so right about like writing or painting or music, so much of it is what's in between. So much, I mean, can you imagine music without the pauses and without the silence? Or can you imagine a love scene without the pauses? And for that matter, any scene. You know, what's not there, what you leave out, what you hint at, is oftentimes so much more powerful. Like that example in the book where you have the E without one side, and you can't look at it once you know it's the capital E, which is a word we use, you know, I mean, a letter we use more than anything else. It's impossible not to see it the same way. So sometimes what you take away and leave to the imagination or let us fill in ourselves is way more memorable, more powerful, right?
Yeah, and if you think about some of the stickier kinds of products that we all use now, you know, the Instagram kinds of apps, it's really about what's missing. We're afraid of missing out on something, and it's that fear of the gap that drives us to look at you know, our smartphones, you know, every 30 seconds, make sure that we're not missing anything, and there's an easy way to just sort of swipe through everything, but. I think that sort of mystery and intrigue is what drives a lot of the stickier kinds of and big businesses that have blossomed out of those kinds of products.
What do you know? This is something you've written these books and you've gotten pretty. I mean, it's pretty deep stuff in some ways. I mean, it's the wrong word, but it's pretty eye opening. Just all the different examples. And how has it changed your life? I mean, when you do a. I love the idea of, you know, we all have these to-do lists every year. And my New Year's resolution, and it's so much better to start with the not-to-do list. And I think you talk about, you know, kind of one of the guys who sort of writes this not-to-do list, things he's not going to do this year. And then I guess there's the to-do list that he has, and he eliminates the bottom 20%.
Yeah.
I just love that stuff. I love it, man.
It sounds easy, but it's difficult. I read that was what you're referring to, an essay in 2003 that I read just after I had the little experience where I began to, you know, look at things differently. And it's sort of when you're out of all the traditional things that have worked in the past, you're out of options, you're out of alternatives, you start casting about for new ways of solving problems. And that just happened to be on my radar screen because of that. It was an end of the year essay, and it was by Jim Collins. You know, far more successful as a writer and a management educator than I'll ever be.
Until now, because you're on the Brian Hunter Mott show. Keep going.
But yeah, the title was Best New Year's Resolution: A Stop Doing List. And you know, it was. He told the story of how he left Stanford Business School and did sort of what every, you know, upstanding MBA student does. They take a job at a big company. His happened to be Hewlett-Packard, and they start sort of, you know, scratching and clawing their way to the middle.
Right.
And he went back to Stanford and was a guest lecturer in his favorite course there, which was about creativity and innovation in business. And his professor sort of took him aside and said, you know, hate to tell you, Jim, I don't think you're happy. I think you might want to reconsider the path you're taking. What seems to light your fire isn't really what you're doing. I know you well enough to say that. And she gave him a thought exercise, and it went something like this. Imagine that you've got 10 years to live, and you've been given $20 million free and clear.
Yeah, I love it.
What would you do? More importantly, what would you not do?
Mm.
And what rose to the top of his not-do list was his job, which he promptly quit and started a completely different career path. But yeah, that stop-doing list, you know, you come up with all your goals, whether they're daily tasks, whether they're your quarterly goals. We're really good at that. We love to make the to-do lists. We're very ambitious. We're very optimistic. But then after you prioritize them, the hard part is to cut out the bottom 20% and throw them away forever. Don't ever look at them again. And the reason you want to do that is, A, if you do get to them, which we hardly ever do, you'll sub-optimize your performance on them anyway. So just get rid of them.
Yeah,
it's a discipline.
What happens if you realize you don't want to be an actor anymore, but that's your only skill set?
And what if the people really want you to be?
The people, my fans. Well, I would never do that to my fans. The people would tear, they would tear the whole town apart. You think Ferguson was bad. Brian's not acting anymore.
You become a director or producer, don't you? I thought that's what you did.
Yeah, I guess so. Just so I can be a dictator. I'm just not, I don't have an attention span there. That's the problem.
Is that the advantage of being a director? You get to be a dictator without attracting the attention of the UN?
Very true. I want to talk a little bit about elegance, in pursuit of elegance. It's one of my favorite words. I once heard, you have a quote in, I think it's the Laws of Subtraction, where you talk about Keats, and he says, truth is beauty and beauty is truth. There's another way to define beauty. The Greeks define beauty in one word as well, which is harmony. And I think of elegance and harmony as very closely related. Talk a little bit about, you know, you wrote this with about Guy Kawasaki. Talk a little bit about In Pursuit of Elegance, and it says why the best ideas have something missing. I love that title.
Sorry
about the general. Hey, hey, Matthew, just take this and go.
Yeah,
it's such a beautiful sort of vast ethereal topic that I just wanted to, you've spent a lot of time thinking about it, so I guess.
Okay. No. Yeah. Well, the whole thing stemmed out of the difficult time that I had at this company called Toyota. They had this informal mantra that went something like this: people don't want our products and services, they want solutions. And when it comes to solutions, simple is better, elegant is better still. But I could ask 10 different people, what do you mean by elegant? And they couldn't give me a working definition. And that made my life pretty difficult. I knew by virtue of the fact that certain ideas got rejected, anything that was excessive or wasteful or hazardous or hard to use, unnatural or even ugly, got rejected. So I sort of knew what elegance wasn't, but there was no real working definition of it, and I was sort of left to my own devices to come up with it. But I think about elegance in two ways. So the harmony thing. There's two kinds of harmony, and the kind of harmony that is perhaps the most elegant is the kind of harmony that, and I forgot, you know, it's a Greek quote, and it may have been Heraclitus who said it, but it's the kind of harmony that exists between a bow and an arrow, or a bow and a string, that kind of tension, right, that creates, this potential.
Right.
But my own definition is fairly simple. Working definition of elegance is achieving the maximum effect with the minimum means. And in a go forward kind of way, I focus on the second half of that, the minimum means. What's the minimum I need to do, because we're all sort of lazy, to achieve the maximum effect?
Yeah, there's that 20-80 principle too.
Yeah.
The pea farmer who said 20% of his effort.
Pareto's law.
Pareto's law, yeah.
And I just started looking around the world. You know, Toyota is one thing, but there are other ideas out there. And as I began sort of traversing the world and talking about elegant solutions, I began collecting ideas. And the kind of ideas I was interested in is where something had been removed, something had been subtracted, reduced, and greater impact had occurred. So, I don't know, I just found that to be, very powerful. We're in a resource-restricted world as it is, yet we're surrounded by excess. Just the whole, I don't know, that whole tension, for some reason fascinated me. And you know, if you pay attention, there are a lot, especially in the entertainment world, there are a lot of stories, ideas, that where something's been removed, and gosh darn it, triple the impact. I mean, the ending of The Sopranos is the opening story of In Pursuit of Elegance, and I just thought that was an outstanding example of how you triple your impact by removing a standard feature of virtually every story out there, the ending.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's, I mean, one of the interesting things, I mean, I can't remember, the guy who developed the FedEx logo, he talks all the time about 1 + 1 = 3. Like, that's really the goal, is to have it add up to something that's much greater than just the sum of its parts.
Yeah, you know, I'm still fascinated by the fact that not everyone sees the hidden arrow in the FedEx logo.
There's a hidden arrow in the FedEx
logo. I didn't know
logo.
That. I'll tell you what I'd like you to talk about that I found fascinating was Jackson Pollock. And fractals, and the idea that Pollock was painting so you know, you can, when you look at his paintings, you know, oh well, if you're not really, don't have an educated eye like myself, although I've seen a movie on him that was pretty good, I think it was called Pollock and blah blah blah, but you know, you'd think, well, he just was the first guy to actually splash paint on a canvas, and it was just, you know, it was kind of shocking, and he said it was art, and it was different because everybody had been using brush strokes. And then after reading your book, I realized, well, in fact, there are a lot of people that could splash, and good painters that could splash paint on a canvas with deliberate intention. And it wouldn't have the same effect. Our eyes would not be drawn to it. What is it about Jackson Pollock that people go to a museum and look at? What is it about, Blue Poles that would fetch a $40 million price tag? Well, I don't know. It made no sense until I read the fact that he was painting, I guess the best way to say it, in a harmonious way with nature. He was painting with nature. You use that incredible example of the guys in the moors in England where they rig up paint canisters, and the paint splashes the paint on the canvas in accordance to the velocity of the wind and the force of the wind. So every time the wind would blow, and so pretty soon you had this incredible sort of tapestry that was painted essentially by nature, by the storm itself. And the reason that your eye goes to that is because nature has a certain harmony. It creates fractals, and correct me if I'm wrong, so fractals are sort of, you know, if you were to look at a coastline, if you took a very small section of that coastline, it would mirror the entire coastline in many ways. That was a really long
yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's the only way that anyone has been able to copy the inherent nature of a Pollock painting is through the forces of the wind, which is, as you say, it's a naturally occurring order that arises out of chaos. He was painting fractals, and when they looked at his paintings under magnification, 100 times magnification, the patterns are the same as the larger pattern of the painting as a whole. So a fractal is a simple self-repeating pattern. No matter how far into it you get, it's the same pattern. And, you know, think about, a head of broccoli and how it's shaped. And then think about the little piece of broccoli that gets caught in your teeth. It's the exact same shape as the larger stalk. That's what a fractal is, and it is naturally occurring. It is a mathematical formula, but he was painting in fractals, and that's why there is a certain calming effect to, the same calming effect that you get from looking at blue poles that you get from the waves at night crashing on the sand of the beach.
One thing, as you said in the book too, like Pollock was painting fractals before mathematicians even knew about fractals, really, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Which is, I think, extra amazing, because so often when we hear like, oh, there's, you know, some sort of mathematical principle to this art, we often think, oh, that was cute, they took the math and put it into the art. But he was doing it in the art before there was even the math.
And we
25
know,
years before.
Yeah.
And we think it was probably deliberate because he spoke about paint. He was nature. I mean,
yes.
He kind of said that. That's why he was in the painting and stuff, right?
Yep, exactly.
Damn, that's so unbelievable to me. It really gives you a different, you really look at him in a very, very different way. I know he always kind of hinted at it. I know that there wasn't him saying, I'm painting in fractals here, but that's just fascinating to
me. Yeah, the word hadn't even been invented. Wouldn't be invented until 1970s, and he passed away, late 50s?
Yeah,
right?
but how was he doing it in terms of how was he able to use his body to create fractals? That's what I want to know, and other painters are not.
No clue. I have no clue. It just for some reason the energies of the universe somehow channeled through him, and he the reason I wanted to include his story was the notion of he had somehow gotten out of the way of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? And which is sort of what you started the interview with, is how do we get out of our own way and remove the stuff that we inadvertently put in the way of our sort of natural creativity.
Mm.
Well, and I mean, that's, I mean, you know, you talk about this also in the books. I mean, that's why people have great ideas in the shower. That's why people have great ideas in meditation and after they sleep on a problem and all that sort of stuff, because the conscious mind in some sense drops away and then you can connect with something deeper.
Yep. Yeah. And the ability to turn that conscious brain off is, you know, that's, there's a certain zeitgeist around that right now. You know, there is a, I believe it's a 7-month, or it used to be a 7-month waiting list at Google University for their 7-week meditation course.
Whoa,
so
really?
Science has caught up to the fact that it's the quiet mind that produces the kind of sudden creative insight that gives you that nice aha moment. Well, and you can't speed that up. You just got to back away from it.
Yeah, but science in general has caught up to the fact that the non-rational mind is not just some sort of aberration, but actually has function and has benefits.
Yep.
I mean, a lot of the people that we've had on have talked a lot about that in terms of the role that emotions play in thinking, the role that, you know, heuristics play in thinking, the role that mindset, all of these things that, you know, for centuries were sort of the Enlightenment regarded as fuzzy and unimportant, and even spirituality too.
Yeah, science has sort of reversed the old notion was in neuroscience that it was the gray matter of the brain, the physical brain, that controlled the connections we call the mind. But now that's been reversed. Neuroplasticity is the ability of thought to actually produce new connections, new physical connections, and actually change the base, you know, the shape of your brain, so to speak. Not in terms of the physical shape, but the kinds of connections that it has. So it's been reversed, which is kind of a cool thing.
I think that we're plagued in many ways in our thinking, and I'm just talking about most people I know, including myself, and when there's a problem, we do try to throw things at the problem, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what happens in our foreign policy, for God's sake. I mean, if you look at the mistakes made in the Iraq War, I mean, you could also say we should never have been there in the first place. That's one way of looking at the law of subtraction. But there were ways that would have probably, if we've had a number of experts on this podcast about that, there are a number of ways where if you had left a lot of the structures in place, if you had done way less, we wouldn't be facing this terrible insurgency, which now has turned into ISIS, et cetera, et cetera. It's all hindsight. But you got to learn from those mistakes.
Well, but that's the point, is that it's not hindsight. Like, it's diplomatic to say that it's all hindsight.
Right.
But the point is that there were people like John Nagle and a lot of other people who were saying this stuff beforehand, in the same way that, you know, we can say, oh, with hindsight, we all, you know, it's easy to see the 2008 financial crisis.
Right.
But there were a lot of people before the 2008 financial crisis who were saying this is going to be a problem.
Mm.
And I think we do ourselves a disservice to not recognize that there are those voices that are there that are warning us about these things, and we don't pay attention to them.
Yeah, and also to more importantly take that as a lesson, and next time, as opposed to thinking, let's throw all these issues at it. What is something we can? What is the law of subtraction? What can we? Is there a more elegant solution to this issue? And a lot of times, you know, I have to believe as I get older and read books like yours, that sometimes doing way less is more, like the photographer who shoots hippos. And when a hippo comes at you, a 2-ton hippo comes at you, I mean, personally, I go right for the legs, but if you're not me, I jump on its back. But if you're not me, apparently you're supposed to literally do nothing, stand still.
Yeah,
you can kiss my ass, by the way, on that. But I mean, Ain't that crazy? I mean, but it's true, right? You just don't move.
Well, and I think you're onto something with the, you know, you mentioned hindsight. The important part of that word, I think, is sight.
Mm.
And I think that what we aren't good at, and where the discipline perhaps lies, is an observation. We leap right to action, just because it's, you know, that's our bias, especially in the Western world, if you will. It's far less prevalent in Eastern cultures, but we leap right to action. You know, God forbid that anyone sees us staring off into space, daydreaming at a desk. You know, we're being unproductive if we're not moving.
Right.
But you know, back to the Pollock thing, it was the reason I wanted to tell that story also was that I spent time with an urban designer who is designing what's called shared space. In Europe, in the United Kingdom, and it's starting to catch on here in the States. Shared space is a notion of removing traditional controls, which is what we like to do when every time there's a crisis. Man, it looks like it's out of control. We need to put a control in place.
Right.
It turns out if we step back, take a look at the patterns that are occurring, the natural patterns that are occurring, that there's probably less that we have to do. And as a matter of fact, it may right itself if we stand and watch it just for a little bit. And that's what he's doing with the traffic intersections. He watches natural patterns and movements of human beings, of vehicles, of bicycles. Lo and behold, with the right context, with the right social context, you don't need all the traffic lights and all of the lines and all the signs, because all that does is take away our ability to interact with other human beings and be intelligent.
Well, that's what really got me on this book.
Yeah, we had a long conversation about shared space.
I flipped out because, first of all, you know, I like to call myself a libertarian. I always say, let the marketplace decide. And I think that there's way too much intervention from both sides. I mean, I'm not talking about Democrats or Republicans, but there tends to be all this idea again. We got to regulate and get involved in the marketplace. And I think that is a shared space that I think usually regulates itself. But this traffic idea, this guy who created, I think it's in Holland, mm-hmm. and there's an intersection where he basically took out all or most of the traffic signs. And guess what? Trucks, bicycles, motorcycles, cars, and pedestrians figure it out. There have been way less accidents. And one of the things he likes to do, since he designed it, is to, I guess, cover his eyes and walk backward into traffic.
Yeah.
You know, that's really putting your money where your mouth is, man.
Yeah.
But it was so eye-opening to me. It's just incredible. And it makes sense that people can figure things out on their own because there's a natural rhythm to things.
And yeah. there was a great story that you told in there. I think it was from a woman who was commuting in Virginia, and that the best day of her commute was when all of the traffic lights broke down. Would you mind telling us about that?
Yeah, I mean, and there's, you know, there's that story, and all you really need to do is you can get on YouTube just search for, I think it's on BBC Two. There's a segment called "When You're in Your Car, They Can't Hear You Scream."
Oh my God!
And there's footage of because people say all the time, this it's great in the smaller towns, it's not going to work in a metropolitan area. Well, there's footage of a busy intersection in London with all the traffic controls working perfectly, and it's complete gridlock.
Mm-hmm.
Complete
wow.
gridlock. And then they have the same intersection when the power goes out. And it's not fast flow, but things are moving.
Right.
And people are looking at each other. They're signaling to each other. So, and it's, you know, and all you got to really do is Google, you know, traffic in India to see, you know, this where I was in India a couple months ago. They have no traffic controls and things flow and they flow pretty fast. Turns out that traffic controls were something arbitrary that England put in place back in 1929 when motor cars started becoming popular and roads started getting bigger, and they'd said, all right, all of a sudden there's a right of way. People merging onto the primary roads from a secondary road don't have right of way. The primary road does. And vehicles have right of way over everything else. And there was no study done. It was just a control put in place. And you can find study after study on the ills of traffic controls. There was even a book written, I believe it was called Traffic, about this, but you can't find, and I looked, a study that says how much better things are because we have all of these traffic controls. It just takes away our ability to think. And the gentleman I spoke to, who is the protege of the guy you're talking about, who walked into traffic backwards, who passed away, 6 or 7 years ago.
Not in a traffic accident.
A traffic accident.
Cancer. Yeah.
Hans Monderman was his name. But Ben Hamilton Bailey, one of his favorite quotes to me was, "You don't need a sign in your living room saying don't spit on the floor."
Yeah, man. That's right. And you know, we always talk about I want the the show, the under caption, the moniker, whatever it is, to say, because the best ideas are stuck in books. This is an idea that's still stuck in a book, in several books. I mean, if you told most people, everybody, including myself before I read your book, that traffic signals and signs were not really needed. In fact, they might contribute to traffic accidents. I would have told you were out of your mind.
Right.
I wonder if there's been any momentum in this country by any kind of municipality or any county to kind of try this out.
Yeah, there's some spaces in the Carolinas where they're starting to do this. So the whole thing began in the 70s. It started with a couple small towns that didn't have the budget for traffic controls. And so there's some design of these. It's not just no traffic controls whatsoever. There are very carefully placed items and things that produce a certain kind of ambiguity and a certain kind of uncertainty so that you're left to your own devices. And there's sort of the unwritten rule of first in turn with all due respect to those most vulnerable, which is essentially to say, take care of yourself and take care of others in a sort of human-centered way. So, and it became 400 towns. It then started in the UK. Dozens of towns redesigned, retrofitted their traffic intersections to be this way, and they finally used it to redesign Exhibition Road in London, which is the huge cultural road that runs right up against Hyde Park, where all the academies and museums are, in advance of the 2012 Olympics. It was a cold, unfriendly, cars-only kind of place, and they redesigned it to be friendly to all with the same rule in place. It's there for everyone. Just be careful.
Do things break down when you get over, when you start traveling at over 25 miles an hour, though?
Yeah, there is a certain speed, and that's where the design principles come in. Over a certain speed, things do break down. And so when you see footage of these shared spaces, the thing that you note is that people are not traveling anywhere near as fast through the intersection as we do with lights and signs. It's very slow. It's under, I believe it's about 25 miles an hour, which is essentially the I think it's the fastest a human can actually run for a short period of time.
You've not measured my speed, but keep going. Keep going. I got some options.
But things do flow. You know, what you see there, the thing that's missing is stopping.
Right.
So it's constant. It's constant motion, constant flow, albeit a slower one.
Seems way more pleasant.
I just wanted to take a second to thank Sarah Ashley Bird, who's on the line, who introduced me to your books, and just also ask if she had any questions.
And thank you, Sarah.
Sarah?
Is she there?
She's probably reading one of your books.
She probably is.
I am.
There she is. Damn.
But she let the space. The space.
I know. So powerful.
So zen.
It left us reaching, pouring salt on our tongue and hanging just out of reach with a pitcher of water.
Yeah, but did you see how you guys jumped in to fill the space right away? It's sort of our natural reaction.
Oh, damn it.
I know. Sarah?
Yes. Well, I was actually thinking, as I was listening to you guys talk about the traffic situation, I come from an education background. So I was thinking about how, you know, if there are constraints that you can take off of students in classrooms to promote that or to make room for that kind of engagement and heightened attention and focus.
Like that.
If you had any ideas.
Yeah. Have you looked at what some of the Scandinavian countries are doing with their school systems, Finland in particular? And Finland generally ranks at or near the top of all the intelligence reports, you know, the student intelligence, IQ kinds of reports, yet their school days are far shorter, and there's no homework. There is, it's the best example that I can think of these kinds of principles in the education setting. As a matter of fact, I think there might be a Wall Street Journal article that you could dig up, and I believe the title is something like, Why are Finland children so smart? And when you read the article, what really, you know, clocks you over the head is the things that they aren't doing. if you look at the typical public school system today, so much time is not in the teaching and the learning aspect. It's in the setup. It's in all of the logistics, the scheduling, the moving of bodies from place to place, the interruption.
And behavior management, absolutely.
Yeah. So when you subtract all of that stuff in a thoughtful way, there's far more time for active learning during the day. So take a look at that article. It might be right up your alley.
Oh, great. Thank
well,
you.
Well, there's a book called The Talent Code, and we had the author on it.
Dan Coyle.
Dan Coyle. Yep,
man,
I know
Hunter remembers all the names. But he talks about something called deep practice. And if you have the right coach, you're not practicing for long. I think there's one chapter where the cello player gets a month of practice in you know, a half hour or something.
Because they stop, right? They stop and correct.
Yes, stop and correct. If you talk to any pro athlete nowadays, when they exercise, they're weight training. You'd think they work out for hours and hours a day. No, they don't. They'll blast their legs out. You know, they'll get everything they need in a leg routine to make their legs stronger in literally sometimes 4 or 5 minutes. It's a grueling 4 or 5 minutes. But so much of athletics now and getting ready for big fights or whatever is learning what not to do. My buddy Matt Mitrione is a heavyweight fighter in the UFC and a top-ranked one. And he played pro football for 5 years as well. And he's 36 now. And he was talking for a long time about the fact that he's learned how to be in optimal shape with very little effort. I mean, he listens to his body, and he doesn't crush his body the way he used to. And that, he said, is the most valuable lesson. He wished he'd known that when he was younger.
Well, and you give the example of Lance Armstrong as well.
Yeah, it's a great example, yeah. Of course, he also was a liar and used a lot of drugs, but I do like the example.
But his training methods did change, because I was a big fan, and I love Dan Coyle's books, big fan of Armstrong just up until the end, but he took a lot of the waste out of his training regimen, right? Mm. It used to be 6 hours in the saddle, just, you know, hours upon hours, but really getting specific and focusing on what you need to achieve in a given time and the kind of power levels you have to reach, you know, took a lot of waste out of the training.
How do you live your life? I mean, how has this affected you? What is if you had to give somebody advice? You coach people and things, and I have kids, and I want to impart some of this wisdom to them. Give us a good example of, I don't know, how it's changed your life, what you spend your time not thinking about, what you find most people are thinking about that they shouldn't think about, et cetera, et cetera.
I think I spend more, without getting into sort of nitty-gritty, boring specifics, I think about when I have a decision, there are sort of three choices that we all make, and they're sort of in the back of our mind. But the choices go something like, what do I do, what do I add, and what do I focus on? Mm. But there's a second half to those choices. So what do I do versus what do I not do? What do I add versus what do I leave out? And what do I focus on versus what do I ignore? I spend more time on the second half of those choices. What do I ignore? Right? What do I leave out or what do I take out? And what do I not do? And it's just sort of that kind of mental filter. And I tried to sort of eat my own dog food in the Laws of Subtraction. I subtracted myself from the book to leave room for stories of about 50 people who have far more powerful stories than I could ever tell that are of a personal nature.
Mm. That's a good answer. I like that. And so I wonder, just I think about these things in terms of my very small children, the 3-year-old and the 6-year-old.
Yeah.
I can already see my 6-year-old stressing out about trying to accomplish certain things, whether it's in karate or it's in, you know, school or homework. And I'm just trying to figure out a way to kind of,
I think that's the thing. It's a large part of it is even just knowing to ask those questions, because so much of it is, I mean, working with students in terms of academics, they always want to throw time and effort and energy at the problem. That's always the thing, rather than looking at, you know, how what actions are going to be most effective.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's just even knowing that the goal is elegance rather than that the goal is getting an A or getting a, you know, whatever else it may be. It's figuring out how to achieve the goal elegantly, because then you're looking both at what you can add and what you can subtract.
Yeah, and I guess when it comes to that's a great insight. I think when it comes to kids, what we sort of intuitively do is, you know, Dad, I want a XYZ toy, right? And then you're in the position of, well, do you get it? Do you not get it? So a more powerful way might be to limit a given resource. Say it's $10. Your child comes to you and says he wants this. And you say, well, I have $10. Let's go to the store and let's see if what you could get for $10. This is how much that toy costs, but what else is there for $10? And they begin to start understanding that I could perhaps get more with this limited amount of $10 rather than just giving it to them. So you sort of want to breed that the choice making.
Yeah.
And the notion that kids can get really creative with a constraint. I mean, we teach them not to, right? But they come into the world being far more creative in a play box, in a sandbox with maybe one or two playthings and a yard full of toys. We start giving them that stuff, and so we sort of siphon off their creativity. But there's an easy way to breathe it back in, is to give them that choice, and you can see the thought processes start to take place.
My kids are going to Montessori school, and I think it's interesting to hear the way the teachers discipline them. They'll say, you can do that, but you know, there will be consequences, and it's up to you to decide how severe those consequences will be. I kind of leave it to your choice. You can operate within these boundaries and these confines. If you choose to step out, it is your choice. But there will be some pushback on the side of the universe over here.
Yeah. Going to,
and it's really a neat way to look at things. We're giving you the responsibility to choose how severe you want these consequences to be. They also teach them to follow their curiosity. And it is regimented, and there are confines, there are boundaries. I've been really impressed with that. But within that, you're able to find your own way and make sense of it. Yep. Given these tools. So have you done any research on that, on Montessori school?
No, well, my daughter started her schooling at Montessori as well, and I love that approach. I've often taken her teachers, as she got up into upper grades, to task on things that they will do that just fly in the face of everything I know to be wrong. For example, let's say that a teacher wants her class to, and Sarah, you can correct me if I'm wrong, if this is completely off base, but so a teacher wants to have her class read more books.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that teacher do? That teacher decides to throw an incentive out there. And that incentive goes something like, I don't know, maybe it's more coupons to Taco Bell. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more books you read, the more coupons you get. And well, what does that end up doing? Well, sure, it spurs people to read, spurs the kids to read books. But the kinds of books that they read are the kinds that they can finish very quickly. They tend to be superficial, sort of mind candy kinds of things. And they get the coupons. Right. And even the good readers, the ones that are a little bit more advanced, they're a little bit more in the way of loving reading for the sake of reading. They start shifting away from the things that they're reading. Why? Because they're tempted by the coupons or whatever the incentive is,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, yeah, everybody starts reading these books. And then, lo and behold, the teacher runs out of money for coupons. There's no more money for incentives. What do you think happens to reading in her class?
Yeah.
Disappears.
It goes away.
Yeah.
Even though she's now converted, or he's converted, the good readers to no readers by inadvertently adding something, the incentive that isn't necessary in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So what would you do in that circumstance?
In terms of
getting them to read more?
You have to find the things. It's sort of what the Montessori way is. Find the things that interest them.
Mm.
Rather than assign one book that everyone needs to read, give them the options. And they will gravitate to the things that sort of have some connection to them. Once you have that connection, then it's a pull. It's not a push.
Mm-hmm.
I've struggled with this with my daughter, you know, since the get-go. And it was, for her, it seemed to be all about, and I think it came from the school system, how many pages she had completed, where she was in the book. But when you were to ask her about the book, she really couldn't tell you. It was mostly an achievement thing. I got to finish this number of pages. I read 10 pages, and I got 3 chapters done. Well, tell me about the main character.
It's a little bit like when you have a conversation with people. I used to do this all the time. I'd be talking to somebody, and I found that I wasn't really listening to them. What I was doing was waiting for me to throw my point of view in there so that that guy and everybody around me could understand just how much I knew about the subject as well. You know, I mean, that's a habit I had to and continue to have to work really hard. That's why this podcast has been amazing in that sense, just having to really listen to what's going on. Don't worry about your point. You want to throw your point in, but I think we all do that to an extent. You can tell very quickly where people aren't really listening and being affected to what's been being given to them by somebody in front of them, rather they're waiting to get their. It's how you see a lot of arguments. I mean, you get two sides that yell their point of view at each other. They make a statement and then they try to sell it to the person. And instead of
which is frankly a discussion. That's the point. You're in essence not recognizing the other person's humanity.
Well, you mean like politics? You mean like watching. But, most of the news and the debates, it's unbelievable.
But I mean, in terms of what you're saying, Matthew, about education, you know, that's the thing. The process that you're talking about, the Montessori process, really requires you to engage with the kid, figure out what's going on with the kid, have a conversation. Like it's an effortful process that requires engagement, as opposed to just like, here's a stack of coupons. I'm gonna like do my thing. Peace.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we, you know, we all have, and this is why when I work with teams, I like to do problem solving as a team, because given eight people in the room, everyone has a different bias, everyone has a bit of a different agenda, and my own bias may not be apparent to myself because it's part of my own thinking, but gosh darn it, I sure see everyone else's. And we're able to see everyone else's agenda far more clearly than we see our own. So I like to work with diverse teams because those perspectives sort of produce this, I don't know, kind of creative soup that facilitated in the right way gets you to the kind of elegant solution that makes for a great product or a service or a strategy or anything.
Well, amen. I mean, I wish more people... That's just a constant process of it's. I don't know. It's very human to be tribal and decide that you have all the answers. That's probably what my problem with religion is.
But that's also that's also a problem of not religion as well, right? The new atheists are also incredibly tribal.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, I think let's not take it beyond
what Hunter said. Yes.
Yeah. But it's a function of humanity, but that's also the function of education, right? Education is the re-education of desire, you know, and it's a bringing out and all of that sort of stuff. And I think what's interesting as well is there's such a strong Zen Buddhist theme that runs through your books, Matthew.
Yeah.
A lot of those concepts are very Zen, you know, the recognition that it's not just the pot, but that the space within the pot is actually what performs the function rather than the pot itself. So, I mean, you know, I think a large part of it is just, you know, it is all of us raising our awareness and becoming conscious of a lot of things that we don't necessarily think of.
Yeah, and I fully accept that. I am not I wouldn't classify myself as a Zen practitioner, but I'm sure I am very appreciative of that point of view, and I think it comes from breathing the air inside of Toyota for so long. Even though I worked mostly here in the United States, the exposure to just that Eastern way of thinking that's far more relaxed with nothingness than we are just sort of seeped into my makeup, I guess.
And not just relaxed with it, but also appreciative of it, you know? Yep. I mean, that's such a thing that's cultivated in Zen art.
Yeah, and it's, you know, what was the movie that Tom Cruise was in? Is it the Last Samurai?
Last Samurai,
Last Samurai.
Yeah. So he's in. So he's been, you know, he's out in the feudal samurai village, and I think there's a wonderful quote. He says something to the effect of, "I've never run into a people or encountered a people that are so concerned with perfection and mastery." Something like that.
By the continual, the repetition, the daily repetition.
Yeah, you know? Just that constant pursuit of perfection, understanding that it's not something to be achieved, but it is something to be pursued. Because in the Zen view, perfection cannot be achieved. You know, Buddha achieved it. Buddha's dead. Because perfection is about, if you look at a definition in the dictionary, it may say something like, point beyond which no improvement is possible.
Well, that's basically what Plato's Forms is about, isn't it? I mean, you'll never reach perfection, but you can imagine what it is, and you should always reach for it. So you can never be the perfect person, but you can imagine what that would look like and strive to be that.
Yep.
That's always been, so it's amazing how there's through lines in different cultures.
But that's the other thing too. I mean, part of it is perfection is defined by what your goal is, right? And so something may be the most perfect depending on a particular goal, but it's not necessarily the most perfect in any sort of absolute sense.
Right.
I also think that if you start trying to be perfect in things like stand-up comedy or, the things, the way I make my living, or writing for that matter, good luck. I don't even know what that means. That's going to tighten you right up. I mean, a lot of it has to be the exact opposite in some ways. I don't know. I mean, Miyamoto Musashi in his book, The Book of Five Rings, he talks about practicing the drawing of a sword, real sword fighting. Not that I've had too many sword fights, but, according to Miyamoto, I can't talk about it. But when I go into battle, it's usually just a small sword, but it's silent. But he talks about how the idea that you parry and block, and that's the movies. I mean, it was before movies, but he said that's not true. Real sword fighting, you get basically it's the guy who gets the first strike. And he would practice pulling his sword out of his scabbard and this perfect swing, this, I guess, downward swing. And he said, if you practice that and practice that and practice that, pretty soon the thing in itself, the thing of it itself, the spirit within the sword or whatever it is, reveals itself to you. You kind of become one with you gain universal understanding, a little ethereal and stuff. But certainly there is an elegance to that. There is a harmony and an elegance to practicing something over and over the right way.
Can I ask you a question, Brian?
Yes.
Is it ethereal? I mean, isn't that an experience that we've all, to some extent, touched in our lives?
100%. If you practice, I'm just saying, I'm an ethereal in terms of when you start talking about being one with the universe.
But people back off from that idea. But that's a feeling that I think we've all had.
There are laws, and also
that is now understood by. I mean, that's what Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, the man of the unpronounceable name. Although I did just pronounce it, but
God, Hunter's so good with names, man.
No, I actually listen. I owe that to Martin Seligman. Because finally, after years of just being like, he put in a pronunciation key in one of his books and was like, this is how you pronounce this name.
Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
Mihai. Right. But, the whole experience of flow, I mean, the characteristics of flow are that you drop out and you become one with the universe. Jonathan Haidt talks about transcendence.
Yeah.
That's an experience that's available to all of us.
Now, have you seen video of me having sex? Is that what you're talking about here? I don't know, Matthew. I'm sorry.
Was it video?
No, they were old tapes, man. That was back when I needed the money. I would never dream of doing it anymore. Plus, I'm married. My wife rolls her eyes. I don't want that. I don't want people seeing that stuff.
But now you guys know when you're in flow, right? You're in the zone.
Yes.
Whether no matter what you're doing, it feels effortless.
Yeah.
It feels the most effective you've ever been. It just, everything is clicking. And then there are days where everything just feels like I need a little bit of WD-40 everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's usually when you haven't been practicing, in a way. There's a comic, if I haven't been on the road, when I'm on the road, I'll do, probably 3 hours of comedy a night. And when you're doing that a lot, you start out and you haven't done it, and you start out and you're doing stand-up and you're thinking about the jokes, right? So you've got bits and you're going through it and you're trying to keep the rhythm and stuff. And by the third night or whatever it might be, or if you've been on the road a while, you're no longer even thinking about that. You're kind of managing the audience's energy. You're almost, this is going to sound really, I don't know, I don't want it to sound like cocky. I don't mean it that way. I've just been doing it long enough. And I talked to you about this, Hunter. You feel like you're playing the audience like an instrument. You're breathing air into them. You're taking the air out because you can't breathe too much air. You can't get them laughing too much in the beginning. They'll get tired if it's an hour and 15-minute show. So you kind of have to pause and let them just take you in for a sec, And that's something I never would have done when I was starting. I didn't know what that even meant. But the more you do something, I guess it takes on a very different feel, form, and meaning, for that matter.
Yeah, it's not about the joke, right? It's
no.
about something greater.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's the thing. I don't think it's cocky at all. I think that's it's only seems cocky if you think that it's about you. And the whole point is that it's not about you. This is about what the experience of mastery is. You know, I'm sure that Yo-Yo Ma has the same experience. I'm sure that anybody who really mastered a skill, whatever that skill may be, whether it's, you know, doing science or whether it's doing, you know, Rena Marie doing voiceover, you know, there you become so, those skills become so automated that you can now step out of them and really just sort of be in the moment.
Well, one of the most, I don't know if you're a jazz fan, Matthew, but I was with I know Harry Connick Jr. And one time I said, "How good are you?" You know, and he said, "I don't think I have any peers, man." You know, we started laughing. We started laughing.
That sounds like something he would.
Yeah, yeah. But what he did was he said, we were at the concert that night, and he said, "You know, my friend Brian asked me how good I was, and I said, well, I guess I'm the best in the world." And the whole audience laughed. And he said, "But maybe I can give you a couple ideas of why I think so." And he started playing two different rhythms with one hand. And then he started doing it, playing two different rhythms with the other hand.
Wow.
And then he started to hit the snare and hit something else with his other foot. And so he was doing four, five, six different things, and talking to us as he was doing the six different things. And they were all very different, but somehow they were all working together.
Wow.
And he said, "See how they're not really working together right now? But now I'm going to start working them together. Let's see if we can create a little bit of a melody and a harmony." And they said, now, if I just started to sing, now things would get really interesting. And he started to sing, and I was like, oh, I tried to pull my underwear off and rubber band them on stage. They wouldn't let me. I was literally like, "I love you." It was the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. I thought I was straight this whole time, and apparently I'm not. So, you know, it was just a beautiful, beautiful example of mastery.
Yeah.
You know. Well, Matthew May, I want to thank you for your books, your mind, your hair, and your attitude, sir.
Most welcome on all counts.
You should be on a horse riding on a ribbon of white sand. You're not my type, but I'm just saying, just to create beauty in the world, or at least frolicking through a field of wheat. Something.
Totally shop is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's probably like a double. It's not even you in the picture. Welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Really great. And I wanted to get into Sudoku. I don't know anything about
Sudoku?
It.
Sudoku?
Yeah.
Sudoku.
Yeah. Do you play that game?
I did for a very long time.
You did?
It's habit forming.
What did you like about it?
The simplicity. I mean, it's just one rule. The infinite number of puzzles that are out there. There's a bit of creativity to it. At the same time, there's logic to it. So the notion of right and left brain, very simple framework. And it's about something that's mostly not there and that you fill in.
Okay, because I tried to read the rules in your book and I couldn't figure it out. So maybe puzzles are not for me.
Brian.
Sorry, Hunter. Matthew May, ladies and gentlemen, if you want your life, if you want to understand something about life, you might want to read In Pursuit of Elegance, Why the Best Ideas Have Something Missing, and The Laws of Subtraction, Six Simple Rules, essentially for, I'm trying to find the, for winning in the age of excess everything. Well titled, and they're both great reads. Easy reads and really and actually you won the 2013 Small Business Book Award for economics in this.
That was the Shibumi strategy.
It says
a lot
opposite.
Of Zen stuff. It's a little fable.
Okay, I'll have to read that next. It's the only book I haven't read, but read that as well, ladies and gentlemen. Only if you want to learn more and have a better life. Thanks to Matthew May for joining the number one podcast of all time. Brian Callen, Hunter Motz. Is that dramatic enough for you, Matthew?
That works for me.
I can never really end things.
But now, Brian, try it with subtraction.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, Thank you very much.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you saw that.
That was good. Yeah, thank you very much. The space was really... That's right. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Sean Penn earlier, because that's what I got when you did that.
I'll leave you with this idea. Matthew, I'll leave you with this thought. John, I'm with John Leguizamo. We're eating breakfast at Chateau Marmont, as if that's not a big enough name to drop.
Two in one sentence.
Yep. Philip Seymour Hoffman comes up, says hi, start talking to him. This is unfortunately 2 weeks before he dies. And Sean Penn comes up, and I think this 80-year-old looks a lot like Sean Penn. I'm not kidding. He's got some deep lines in his face.
Yeah.
But the great thing was that when John Leguizamo said, "This is my friend Brian Callen, he's a great stand-up comic," Sean Penn goes, "Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, man. I know your stuff. You're really funny." And I thought, yeehaw! I felt even more excited than the Harry Connick Jr. thing. Anyway, the point of this podcast is to tell you about me and how I know famous people and how they like me. That was the whole point. And then the other side is there's some subtraction bullshit that I guess we can throw in there. Matthew May, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're a good man.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm funny. I mean, I was very funny.
You were, Brian. Yeah. That was really good.
Yeah.
You added laughter.
I added laughter. Damn it! Oh. But I subtracted. I removed remorse. I removed
that's true.
I removed dreck and
glum. And strong, yeah.
It's glum. Glumness?
Glumness.
Shit. I'm just not very articulate.
Yeah.
We gotta go.
And thank you, Sarah Ashley Bird, for the recommendation.
You're welcome.
And for joining.
Sarah, you have a great...
Thank you for letting me listen.
You have a great voice, Sarah.
Thank you.
Jeez, I sound so creepy. Sarah, you got a really great voice. Thanks. I'm going to give you my phone number. I'm married, but don't worry about it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I got to go. Thank you very much.
Peace.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.